Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, where I will brag about my the Super Bowl prediction that you saw right here on the DMZ, folks.
So you predicted Seahawks, what, 100-0, and you were close, right?
Well, no, I predicted the Seahawks would win. I said that I was rooting for the Broncos, but I thought the Seahawks would win, and I was right about that. I didn't expect it to be such a blowout, such a boring game. And, you know, I was also, as you remember, I was pretty critical of Richard Sherman's showboating. But I loved, you know, after the game, Russell Wilson, the quarterback for the Seahawks, was all class and gave a great post-game interview. So I'm back. I'm on the Russell Wilson bandwagon now.
And he's very religious, correct?
Yeah, I think he's sort of like Tebow with a Super Bowl ring.
Tebow who could actually play.
Well, Tebow, everyone says he can't play, but you know, all he did was win until he went to play with the Jets. So, you know, he beat the, you know,
he chose the path to sin and he paid the price.
In a playoff game for the Denver Broncos, he beat the Pittsburgh Steelers in overtime. But the guy can't play. That's what everyone says. So
what you're saying is last week we said that conservatives root for Denver and liberals root for Seattle. But you're suggesting perhaps conservatives can take heart in a Seattle victory.
I think so. I think it's not as clear cut as Bill Maher and I perhaps thought.
Perhaps this is red America and blue America coming together in Seattle.
Yes, and I am a fan of the city of Seattle. Actually, I like Seattle a lot. And man, it was dominant. They were fast. They were tough. It was really a boring game to watch, not just because of defense, but because it was so uncompetitive.
You know, I didn't get around to writing this piece. I'm not sure it would have gone anywhere, but the fact that the Super Bowl was boring, I think, is usually the case. I mean, there are obviously exceptions of exciting Super Bowls, but they tend to not be close games. They tend to drag on for a long time. The ads tend to actually suck. And it just reinforces my whole notion that why do people watch sports at all? Why do people expend so much of their day? if you have a pie chart of your time, there's a certain section of America that has a big chunk of it just not playing, not being active, not actually getting out of their house, just sitting on the couch and watching sports. And why do we do this when a lot of the time these games are just not very interesting to watch?
Right. Well, I agree. I mean, the Super Bowls tend to not be that good. The hype, they don't live up to the hype. The 49ers versus the Seahawks playoff game was so much better. And you had two teams that sort of knew each other, that were rivals, that played each other. Much, much, much better than the Super Bowl. I think the 2 weeks off between the playoffs and the Super Bowl probably contribute to the bad game. I think the fact that you have teams who don't normally play each other, who come from different divisions, different conferences, mean that you could have people who are unevenly matched. You know that the 49ers and the Seahawks are going to be a good game because they play each other two times a year and they hate each other and their coaches hate each other. But when does Denver play Seattle? You know, not that frequently. So you don't know if it's going to be evenly matched. But I'll answer your question, Bill, about sports. Because I'll say a couple things. One, football is very addictive for the adrenaline junkie, and it's because of the clock. You know, baseball doesn't have a clock. But when football is really good and when it's competitive, it'll oftentimes come down to the last couple minutes of the game, and then you have the quarterback managing all of these various things, calling timeouts, trying to make a first down before time runs out, trying not to leave too much time on the clock so that the other – it's strategic. It could be fun. This game, the Super Bowl, was completely devoid of any of that, of course. But when it can really get your blood pumping. And I also say, I think there's a communal thing, Bill. Like, I listen to podcasts, Tony Kornheiser, Bill Simmons talk about sports. It's sort of like a soap opera. And it gives guys, not just guys, but it gives people things to talk about that's not business related, it's not political. And you're following this sort of soap opera. You're invested in something. So I think it's probably very healthy to have that outlet and for people to be able to kind of blow off some steam watching games and worrying about something that's not utterly important.
I get the value of recreation in our lives, and I totally get the value of stories and shared stories and communal experiences. I would just think that you have a more if you watch a movie, obviously there are bad movies and good movies, or you watch a TV show, those are literally stories that are designed to have emotional highs and lows, and the good ones, give us that same kind of water cooler bonding experience. And I just feel with sports, it's largely the same story over and over again. I mean, there's formula and everything, but how many people are going to cherish a Super Bowl game beyond the 24 hours after the fact?
I would say a couple things. One, so much of the good storylines have nothing to do with the sport, really. I mean, you've got, take the Super Bowl. You've got Peyton Manning, whose brother has one more Super Bowl ring than him. Can Peyton Manning how can Peyton Manning be considered the greatest quarterback in the NFL when his own brother has more Super Bowl rings than him? You've got Manning coming back from a neck injury a couple years ago, let go by his team, essentially, who didn't want him anymore. They went for Andrew Luck, a younger guy. So here he is trying to prove himself. This game, had Peyton Manning won, I do think he would have been considered definitely in the conversation for the greatest quarterback of all time. Now he dramatically takes a step back. Then you've got the villain, the Richard Sherman, who I think cast himself as the heel to Peyton Manning's face, to use WWE terminology. So there is this soap opera aspect. And I would also say the things that bring us joy and happiness are a lot of times superfluous and irrational, right? So there are a lot of things that we do that are like a waste of time. So, I remember at Christmas time, I took my kids to Alexandria, where they had, we stood out in the cold and we listened to them sing Christmas carols. And that was sort of an ordeal. It would have been easier to just keep my kids at home watching TV than to go out amongst other people in a community. But we did it. And that's part of what being a human is and being part of a community is. And, I took the kids up to see Grandma Hopi, my mom, up in Frederick, Maryland, where I'm from. And that was sort of an ordeal. It would have been easier to talk to her on the phone. But we did that. And I do think that a lot of following sports is a waste of time, and your life would be simpler if you just cut out that part of it and focused on, being successful. But I think those are the things, and football too. It's not like a movie. You could watch a movie anytime, but this is like a communal thing where everybody, this is really the Super Bowl is really like the last communal experience where almost everybody in America is watching the same thing at the same time. And you can talk about it with people and share that experience. So I think it is really much more important than secular liberals like yourself, Bill, want to give it credit for.
I'm sure I don't speak for many. it is watched by so many people. I'm very much the outlier here. But I kind of took a step back from watching sports. And I increasingly asked myself, why was I watching so much sports? What was the point of doing this?
I will say very quickly that I do think it, all things in moderation. I mean, there are people who become obsessed with it and neglect their children and never exercise. They just sit on the couch and watch sports and they put that first and it becomes like a god to them. And obviously I'm not advocating that either, but I do think that being, sports fandom can be part of a well-balanced diet.
Now, back to our normal conversational bonding over politics. I had a piece up at The Week yesterday, which some conservatives don't seem happy with, where I note that there have been three polls. That, we talked last week about Paul Ryan, somebody being the front runner, because he got 20% in the Washington Post poll. What we didn't mention at the time was that Mike Huckabee was not in that poll. And there are two other polls that have been taken since Huckabee's Uncle Sugar speech, where Huckabee is the front runner and Paul Ryan is down in the pack. So I would now discount that Washington Post poll. If Paul Ryan can't be in the front with Huckabee of all people is included, that says to me his base of support is actually quite thin if he's running at all. And Huckabee, granted, is, you know, at about 14%. It's not a commanding lead. And I'm not even arguing in my piece that he is, you know, gonna get it at the end of the day. But it seems like there's something in the Republican water that attracts enough people in the party to whoever's being the most politically incorrect at the moment and who is getting under the skin of the liberal media at the moment, and that person gets catapulted into the top slot, at least for a time. And that kind of warps and drives the whole Republican primary process. This happened in 2012 with going from Michelle Bachmann to Herman Cain to Newt Gingrich to Rick Santorum. Whoever was sticking their finger in the eye of the media at the time got their 15 minutes. And now it seems like we're starting that cycle over again. The guy gives makes one crack about contraception of all issues, and all of a sudden, you know, let's give them the nuclear codes. It's weird. It's a weird dynamic. I mean, Democrats don't do this. When Alan Grayson does a stunt speech on the floor saying Republicans believe healthcare should be die quickly, you know, liberals might laugh and share the YouTube clip around, but we don't make him the front runner. We don't take it that far. And it just seems like this is a theme I've raised you before. Until Republicans can just sort of stop obsessing about fighting political correctness and proving you're above political correctness and trying to be as politically incorrect as possible is something to be celebrated. Until that dynamic fades, it just seems like it's hard to do for the Republicans to take the primary process seriously and take the notion of governing seriously and elevate candidates who have serious governing experiences. It's just odd to me. Do you think I'm putting too much on this?
I mean, I do. You know, I will concede you have a point, and I'll get to that in a minute. But before I do, I want to challenge it a little bit because,
okay,
despite the fact that Republicans have had these dalliances, they've nominated John McCain, a U.S. senator who had a pretty distinguished career, and Mitt Romney. So it's not like they are nominating Herman Cain. I mean, how would you respond to that?
Well, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think the historical evidence shows that the Tea Party wing almost never picks the nominee. That the establishment, you know, side, you know, usually wins the day. They consolidate around a single candidate. The wing nuts tend to splinter. And also the establishment candidate tends to have more money behind himself as well. It was only when Reagan was the conservative standard bearer against a fractured establishment when a conservative movement candidate won the day in relatively recent years. So I'm not arguing that a Huckabee or a Santorum or Ted Cruz is destined to win, but at the same time, I feel like these guys tend to dominate the process and dominate the media attention. And it's not just that the liberal media is loving these people, it's that their voters themselves are putting them at the top of the polls, which makes the media give them the attention. I mean, it's a faction of voters doing it, but it's a big enough faction, and it's a faction that the establishment seems afraid to stand up to and say, you guys are just being ridiculous here. It's ridiculous to make Mike Huckabee a frontrunner based on, you know, a low-rent crack. Instead, you give people cheer him on and try to you know, close the daylight
gap. I'd like to know where this came from, because first of all, I think conservatism is a very coherent and very good political philosophy, and mostly much better than liberalism. And of course, you know, it started off, conservatism started off as an intellectual wonky thing, you know, with, you know, going to Bill Buckley and Hayek and, you know, going back to, you know, obviously Edmund Burke. I mean, it's not like it's devoid of intellectuals or of you know, eloquent and coherent policy solutions. And I don't know, but now for some reason it does seem that the conservative base is into like obscurantism or anti-intellectualism and populism. And some of which I think is actually patently unconservative. Some of which makes sense. And, you know, Reagan was very, very learned, of course, and very well read. But he sort of played up the good old all shucks thing for political advantage to be underestimated. George W. Bush once vowed never to be out-countryed again, and played up his sort of good old boy all shucks thing, even though he was reportedly very well read. You've got Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, who've arrived on the scene in the past couple of decades. I don't know how this happened historically, but it does seem like we've arrived at a point where the conservative base is essentially selling a populist version of conservatism that is very unappealing to college-educated folks or to urban folk or to urban folks. It's a very rural, populist brand of conservatism, if you want to call it that. And, I don't know how to get out of it. And I don't think getting out of it is like becoming, I'm not advocating becoming more liberal at all, but I am advocating, I mean, I think if the conservative movement is to survive and if the Republican Party is to survive, it has to be able to appeal to rural folks and also more cosmopolitan people. Like, it can't be a party exclusively for older white people who live in the South. And I think that is a danger. And so, although I would, you know, dispute a little bit what you're saying, I mean, based on the fact that the party's actually nominated McCain and Romney, I think there is some truth to it, and it's something that I am a little bit concerned about. And we saw it happen with, you know, Donald Trump and Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain, and now Mike Huckabee. And it also, not only does it impact, it doesn't just impact the candidates we're selecting to elevate, but it also impacts how they themselves talk. I mean, I believe that Mike Huckabee can be, I've seen him, he went on The Daily Show one time with Jon Stewart, and had John, at the end of it, Jon Stewart was basically saying, gee, maybe I need to rethink my position on abortion. This is, you know, I mean, Mike Huckabee can be very eloquent and compelling when he wants to be, but sure. I think he sort of was playing to the base a little bit. And even though I think that the media misrepresented what Huckabee said and misportrayed it, he was also sort of playing with fire a little bit too. So I don't want to completely absolve him.
I mean, Huckabee, you know, was a governor, has a record, and is certainly capable of discussing governing ideas. He has done it before. I mean, I'm not saying he is, you know, a joke to his core, but the way he was presenting himself in this one speech, you know, was not with a level of presidential gravitas, and not really, I think, designed to. It was meant to. It's just meant to be provocative and, you know, stir up some media outrage. And it seems like that has a degree of appeal. You know, there's just this politically incorrect itch. I mean, I mentioned this in the piece. You know, here you have the RNC chair who, you know, commissioned this autopsy. So what we need to do in the autopsy says is we need to promote our governors. Because the best ideas are coming from outside of Washington. They list all these governors and all these different ideas that they've done. And in a year past, we've promoted no governors, except for Chris Christie, who's basically promoting himself, and that hasn't worked out all that well. You know, they're not promoting Brian Sandoval, they're not promoting Susan Martinez, they're not promoting...
Susana Martinez will be speaking at CPAC this year, and I think that's the most interesting speech of any that I'm looking forward to seeing.
And I want you to explain that more in just a second. I think I agree with you. I do think it's very interesting. You know, there are folks that they're low key governors out there. I mean, there are some folks like Bobby Jindal are trying. I'm going to repeal the state income tax, which is mathematically ridiculous, and it blew up in his face. But there's other folks just kind of put their shoulders to the grindstone, are just governing fine and get no love. And so what does the RNC chair do this past week? He picks a fight with MSNBC over a tweet because it seemed like they were being politically correct and saying right-wingers were racist and that we need to stand up to that.
We both sort of mocked the RNC for doing that. But I do have to say, Ryan Priebus has picked two fights with the media and he's won both of them. He got CNN to back down for making this Hillary documentary, and he got Phil Griffin to apologize to him.
they already apologized.
But
that was an easy get. The apology was already made.
It's, I don't know. I think it was probably overall bad for the movement and the party that he did that. But it is amazing that like he's picked two fights with the media and he's gotten them to back down on both occasions. But look,
what do you win? What do you win out of that at the end of the day? I mean, how does the GOP brand win after doing that?
Here's the bigger problem, or the bigger sort of dichotomy I see on the right and the left. And maybe it's because Democrats have the presidency now. But I think we can agree that there is a thing where if I'm a governor and I say something, or a senator and I say something really controversial, whether I'm on the right or the left, that could be good for me, you know, because I could raise my name ID and raise more money and become a celebrity. And I think there's a hunger on the right and the left for people who say things that are controversial and like give them hell. On the right, on the Republican side, there is no countervailing force to keep people in check. There is no authority to say, shut up. On the left, there seems to be a disincentive to calling attention to yourself. On the right, there's an incentive to be selfish. You know, maybe it hurts, you know, maybe it hurts the brand overall. I mean, this is like essentially game theory, you know. I mean, the tragedy of the commons. Maybe it hurts the Republican brand overall, but I win if I push the defund Obamacare thing. Therefore, I will push it because it's in my best interest to do so. Well, I think that's at play on the left too, except there is some authority over there that is creating a counterbalance, a disincentive to calling attention to yourself. And that means that they're much more disciplined, that they're much less selfish. I don't know if it's because they have the presidency or what. Bill, I don't think it's just that they're more responsible and better behaved. There has to be a fear if you step out of line, there will be a price to be paid. But who's the enforcer over there?
I do think when you have the White House, you have more adult supervision. I think Karl Rove in the Bush years, you know, kept the fringier aspects of the conservative movement in line.
Early on, at least. Certainly early on.
Yeah.
When they had game. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
But I agree that's a factor here. But I just don't believe that in the Democratic water, there is that same level of mischievousness, mischievousness, if you will. You know, in 2004, you know, Dennis Kucinich never got 15 minutes at the top of the pack. You know, there was never a serious thought that
Howard Dean did, though.
But I mean, you know, Dean, I don't feel is the same, was ever unserious. I mean, Dean catapulted to the top when he delivered a pointed, searing critique of fellow Democrats who were abetting George Bush on Iraq. You know, he was taking on a serious subject. He wasn't making a crack. And, you know, Kucinich did, you know, I mean, Kucinich was, isn't necessarily as humorous as Huckabee did, but he did some more, you know, goofier, unpresidential things. And, you know, he obviously has his fans, but it was, but he never remotely contended in the top tier. And I just don't think there is an appetite for that, even on the, even the fringiest parts of the left. There seems to be an imbalance there in seriousness.
Where does this come from then? Let's assume your premise is correct. When and where did the Republican side of the aisle start being the sort of showman party, and when and where and why did the Democrats start being more, you know, serious, assuming that that premise is true?
I mean, I think it is more recent. I mean, obviously, there's always been divisions. You know, you have, you know, H.W. Bush v. Buchanan in 92, for example. But Buchanan, you know, even though he wasn't an elected office holder, I mean, he was still talking about issues. It still was an issue-based campaign. So I wouldn't put that in the same category of let's make Huckabee the front runner because he made a crack with Uncle Sugar. I think this is this goes back to really the last few years. I don't think it goes back that far. And I'm thinking out loud here, so forgive me if I'm not making a fully fleshed out argument. But I think this perhaps is a kind of end point after 30 years of conservative media, that there's been a refinement of the kind of characterization and misinformation that gets spread around on Fox and on Rush Limbaugh, and it's at a, whereas 10 years ago liberals were worried that it was sort of warping the country and misinforming the broader public, and now I feel just sort of warping the right and leaving the middle of the country alone. And I think that's the problem that the right has right now, that the people that they're listening to are actively hurting them.
There may be some of that. I also think some of it comes from the Clinton era. Like, I feel like that one of the lessons that Republicans learned from Bill Clinton is that symbolism can trump substance, and that Clinton's, you know, ability to connect with people emotionally was something to emulate. And so I think some of it may be like an over, you know, sort of they hated Bill Clinton so much that they had to copy him and try to tap into that. So they sort of maybe put more emphasis on charismatic people as opposed to substantive people. Not to say that Bill Clinton, you know, I mean, he was obviously a governor and apparently spends an hour a day studying the economy. but I still think that the lesson that they derived was when you compare him to George H.W. Bush, that the sort of rock star presidency was upon us. And I think that may account for part of the reason, like subconsciously, why they've kind of gone to the celebrity worshiping thing.
In recent years. Now you had a piece this week arguing that we're in the midst of a '90s revival that is buffeting the nascent Hillary Clinton campaign.
Well, look, I think it's an opportunity for Hillary. It is interesting. You have, if you watched the Super Bowl, you saw there was a Seinfeld reunion, which wasn't funny, but they did it. There was a Full House commercial, essentially a reunion of Full House. Started off with John Stamos, and then Bob Saget and I think the other dude showed up. And this, you know, comes on, you know, the heels of news that they're going to make a Boy Meets World spinoff and a Point Break movie remake. And so it definitely feels like the 90s are getting their dose of nostalgia. It sort of makes sense if you think about it. I mean, in retrospect, the 90s were a pretty damn good time. At least for me, they were really fun. It was post-Cold War, pre-9/11, a time of peace and prosperity. And I think that some of the nostalgia for 90s pop culture owes to the fact that it was like the end of the innocence and that it was just a fun time of peace and prosperity before. There's a great piece in The Onion, by the way, that came out in January of 2001. And it was basically like George W. Bush vows to end the peace and prosperity. And we'll have a war in the Middle East by the end of my tenure, I guarantee it. It's really kind of scary to go back and read it. And we'll get that deficit back up or the debt. There was something special about the 90s. You know, we can look at it as sort of the halcyon days. Now, to be sure, you could argue that the seeds were planted for 9/11 during that time. But that's sort of beside the point. I mean, it's fondly recalled. It seems like a really fun time. And I suspect that Hillary Clinton can sort of tap into this a little bit, at least maybe just subconsciously, and harken back to the way things were, essentially we were balancing the budget and Republicans and Democrats were cooperating with each other, you know, after the 94 revolution, at least to a certain extent. And look, I think some of this is revisionist history too. Like, at the time, the 90s didn't seem all that great. But compared to today, they were pretty darn amazing. And so I suspect that Hillary can find a way to capitalize on that nostalgia, even if it's just a sort of a subconscious thing.
Yeah, I actually think that is a fraught path for Hillary. I disagree with you that the 90s was planting the seeds for Al-Qaeda. I mean, as far as obviously they were doing a lot of plotting in the 90s. You know, they weren't dormant. But the Clinton administration was, I think, ahead of the curve on Bin Laden. He was speaking about counterterrorism quite regularly. He did actively try to get Bin Laden. It wasn't like they weren't aware of the threat. So I don't feel like that was sort of an asleep at the switch, you know, kind of moment in history. Whereas, you know, I think Republicans, you know, could make an argument that, you know, the 90s was sort of, you know, the 20s, in that here's when there was a lot of rah-rah about the economy and you got totally blindsided by the looming.
And you had Greenspan basically keeping interest rates down and trying to keep the bubble, you know, going. And
this is not where if conservatives want to break out of the narratives they've constructed for themselves, I mean, they could start blaming the financial deregulation started with Clinton, and as opposed to saying, well, it's not a deregulation, it's about they help poor people try to get homes. That sort of argument. You know, if they want to break out of that.
You know, I wrote a piece a couple years ago, five Clinton and Bush era policies that brought on the Great Recession, and, you know, Glass-Steagall and the uptick rule and mark-to-market. I mean, there were all sorts of things that people never talk about that were really reforms that were put in. It was basically reforms that FDR put in after the Great Depression, which managed to serve us pretty well for decades, that Clinton and Bush got rid of, that led, you know, at least partially contributed to the housing bubble and other problems that gave us the Great Recession.
I mean, and whether or not Republicans want to prosecute that case, I think it's a certainty that at some point Hillary is going to be asked about Bill Clinton's financial deregulation and asked point blank, was it the right thing to do? Would you do something similar now? How would you do it differently? And I'm sure she's thinking up of her answers for it, but it's obviously a very delicate thing for her to sort of.
I think the question is: does the media give her a pass on it? And I think that depends on whether or not Elizabeth Warren is running against her. I mean, I think Hillary could be very vulnerable to a populist attack, but I don't know that any Republican is equipped. I mean, Rick Santorum, if he was smart, but he's not. So I don't know that like any Republican can hit her from the populist left on that. So it would have to be an Elizabeth Warren. So I think that that's why Elizabeth Warren, that's one of the reasons why Elizabeth Warren could be very dangerous for Hillary, because she is susceptible to all those Clinton era, you know, policies.
I mean, Warren, it seems, I mean, she said she's not running. I take her at her word on that. I mean, the person who's more likely to make that kind of a case might be Brian Schweitzer. You know, he could definitely.
But does he have the charisma and the gravitas to?
Well, he has charisma, maybe not gravitas. He has charisma. I mean, whether he is polling at 50% or 2%, if he's able to get Hillary in a debate with him and TV cameras are in front of the two of them, I imagine he will ask that type of question. Or the media will be compelled to ask the type of question to tease out the differences between the two of them. But even if that doesn't happen, even if Hillary's just flat out uncontested, which I don't think is an implausible scenario here, you know, she's still going to sit for interviews. You know, journalists are still going to ask her questions. And, you know, someone's going to ask that question. And I think that she is going to have to find a way to meet the current, you know, Democratic view that we need, you know, stern financial deregulation, without sounding like, I think my husband was just wrong. Or maybe she does say that. Maybe she feels she's constantly, you know what? We don't agree on everything. And I think he was wrong about that. You know, she could possibly do something like that. But I think she has to figure out in some way. And if I were a Republican, you know, I would try to find a way to revise public perception of the 90s economy as a bit of a smoke and mirrors that was a big bubble and then it wasn't a sustainable.
We were talking about Huckabee earlier, but he's someone who could actually make this point. I mean, aside from Rick Santorum, don't you think Huckabee could make this populist message and hit the Clintons in a way that you can't imagine Rubio or Christie or Cruz doing? Rand Paul could be interesting. I think
all those folks are politically opportunistic enough that if they thought there was value in doing it, they would do it. I think the tough part for any of those folks is once you make that critique,
yeah,
what then is your solution?
I think you have to commit to it. Like Rick Santorum could have branded himself the grandson of a coal miner and could have really made that his message, and he just didn't commit to it, didn't stick to it, would get sidetracked on social issues. Not that they're incompatible, because they're not, but they are a distraction from this messaging. But if he could have stuck to that, he gave a great speech at the Republican convention. I mean, I think it was the best speech at the Republican convention. It was widely overlooked. But there is a sort of, you know, on one hand, I've been, you know, decrying Republican populism. And what I'm talking about, the bad Republican populism is sort of the anti-intellectual demagoguery. But I think there's like a good Republican populism that Reagan played really well. And I think that it's entirely possible that you could use it. Sprinkle a little Buddy Romer in here, a little Mike Huckabee in there, a little Ronald Reagan there, and shake it up. And I think there is a sweet spot. But you got to commit to it because there's pushback. I mean, once you start doing it, there will be the Wall Street Journal hitting you or conservative outside groups who start worrying about you. So you can't just sort of dip your toes in the populist Republican waters, I don't think. I think that, like, this would have to be the strategy, the game plan, you know? Like, it's when you're the Seahawks and you go in and you try to beat Peyton Manning, you have a game plan. And I think beating Hillary Clinton, you sort of have to commit to the game plan, and I don't think Republicans could do it. I think it has to be from the left.
I only got a few minutes left before I have to jump, but I did want to get your thoughts about this Congressional Budget Office report, which is a huge report. It's got a whole ton of stuff in it. I mean, there's about 20 different topics in there. But buried towards the end, talking about the economic impacts of the Affordable Care Act, it projects, I mean, it's not a certainty, it's just their projection, that the labor force is going to be reduced by the equivalent of 2 million full-time jobs, not literally 2 million jobs, but just the amount of work hours that will be done by workers will be reduced by that number. They say it's not because businesses will shed jobs. They say the opposite. It's that workers are going to choose to work less because they don't have to keep their health care. And I know conservatives have jumped all on this, saying Obamacare is going shrinking the workforce. But I know you've also made the point in other contexts that it's good for healthcare to be separated from employment, and that people are making more consumer choice with how with their healthcare. So I wonder if you look at this as a net positive or a net negative. That someone who's 60 years old might say, you know, I'm not gonna work at this job if I don't have to. I'm gonna take early retirement because I'm still gonna have my health care and spend more time with my family because I can do that now. Is that a positive thing or a negative thing because you're losing some labor work?
Well, I think both, Bill. I think that, you know, Republicans did try to like demagogue this issue and use it for political purposes. I think it's a mixed bag. I think, on one hand, one of the few things I like about Obamacare is that it will tend to disconnect healthcare from employment. That was always an artificial thing that was brought about by World War II wage controls, and it essentially, I think, it stifled free agency. You know, where you sort of had to work for the man, and I think it was actually a disincentive to entrepreneurship. You know, it's sort of you were better off working for a company that provided you health care. And so one of the few things that I like about Obamacare is it could be, if Obamacare eventually crumbles, this could be a stepping stone toward getting people off. You know, they're no longer casual consumers of health care. They're now going to be managing their own health care a little bit more via, you know, going to the website and signing up for different things, yada, yada, yada. So that's something I like about it. And look, if there's a person who was, you know, ready to retire anyway, but the only reason they were staying at a job was to get health care, if this sort of moves them, you know, they can now retire, keep their health care or something, and a younger person can take that job, that doesn't bother me. Like, I don't see that as a huge problem. The problem that I do see, though, is where you have a situation, for example, where somebody might otherwise, let's say that they're not near retirement age, they might otherwise take another job or take a promotion, make more money, but it doesn't make sense to do so, because once they start making more money, they would have to pay more in healthcare. They wouldn't get the healthcare subsidies. And so my problem is, when it actually becomes a disincentive for people who really ought to be working more and maybe even want to work more, but it makes no financial sense for them to contribute more to the economy. So I think it's a mixed bag. It's not as bad as Republicans made it out to be, but it's not nothing, as, you know, Barack Obama and the Washington Post want you to believe. I mean, I think it's a case-by-case basis, not as huge as Republicans want you to believe, but I don't think it's nothing either.
Well, I think we'll leave it on that note.
Did that make sense, though?
Oh, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, because, you know, this is my first time talking about this issue.
All right, always good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Bill. Share everybody. Check us out on Twitter.
Yep.
DMZ Show. And on Facebook/DMZ Show.
I don't know what we're going to do over the next 10 months without football to talk about, but I think we'll find a way to make this show interesting.
I'll see rules football.
That is around the corner. That is true.
It's coming up. And also, isn't there some, you know, season coming up? Your molasses season or something?
Oh well, the sugar season is in
sugar season.
That's right. We make maple syrup here in Western Massachusetts, sir, not molasses.
Okay.
Until global warming takes that away from us.
Are you Uncle Sugar during that season?
Oh, I should totally start a Sugar Shack, a local Sugar Shack. the sugar season is tail end of winter. Basically, you need the nights to be below freezing and the days to be above 40 degrees. That loosens up the sap. And that tends to be mid March and leading into the early part of spring. Actually, early March. Yeah, it depends. You know, it moves around. But for those who wanted to plan some New England vacations, I would book now. Hit the Sugar Shacks; they're open for only a few weeks.
Beat the rush. Beat the rush.
That's right.
Avoid the late charges. It's better than going to Sochi. I can guarantee you that.
Well, until next week, sir.
You got it.
Take care.
Stay tuned.